Paid for by government. It's here. Our biggest savings week of the year. Black Friday and Cyber Monday have been rolled into one massive savings event. Now through December 3rd at government.com. For a limited time, enjoy buy more, save more site-wide deals on a huge selection of gold and silver coins. Plus, free shipping on every order. And don't forget about our doorbuster deals. Starting December 1st through December 3rd, our Cyber Monday has incredible doorbuster deals. It's the perfect chance to build your vault or shop for unforgettable holiday gifts. Choose from American gold and silver eagles, brilliant gold and silver bars, ancient treasures, and classics like the Morgan Silver Dollar. There's something for every collector. And remember, every order ships free, delivered straight to your door, guaranteed. Don't wait. These deals won't last long. Visit govmint.com for great deals on gold and silver. That's govmint.com. Government.com.
For those not already familiar with the story of Marty Tankliff, his case began on the night of September 6, 1988, when Marty was just about to start his senior year of high school in an affluent area of Long Island, New York. Marty's father was an entrepreneur and investor who was playing poker with some friends and business associates in the house that night. Marty awoke to two absolutely gruesome scenes in which both of his loving parents had been brutally beaten and stabbed. His mother was dead, his father was dying. When authorities arrived, they kept him separate from any of the adults in his life. As they focused their investigation solely on Marty instead of Marty's father's business partner, Jerry Stuerman, who all signs pointed to being the obvious suspect in this awful crime. In our original 2017 release of Marty's story, we touched on many of these details, but at that time, with ongoing civil litigation, we were not at liberty to delve more deeply into the details of the reinvestigation of Marty's case that ultimately led to his exoneration. In this episode, you'll hear excerpts of that original interview, which included both Marty and false confession expert Saul Kassin, to set the stage for not only the evidence and witnesses that made Marty's freedom possible, as well as all the amazing things Marty has been able to accomplish since winning his freedom, but also what Marty intends to do to bring closure to this harrowing tragedy. This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Let me tell you about a podcast that I'm addicted to. It's called Labyrinths, and it is hosted by two of my favorite human beings. I call her my little sister, Amanda Knox, and her partner, Christopher Robinson. If you're like me, you're navigating your own personal maze. I mean, life, it takes you down these winding paths, dead ends, shortcuts. In Labyrinths, Amanda and Christopher delve into stories of getting lost and found again through compassionate interviews, but much more than that, philosophical rants, playful, really entertaining debate with fascinating people. And I mean, really amazing people. Season one features interviews with Andrew Yang, Malcolm Gladwell, John Ronson, Dave Navarro, LeVar Burton. Expect to arrive at unexpected places when you listen. Check it out, Labyrinths, wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. I'm especially excited today because I have two people who I consider to be, well, let's just call it what it is. They're heroes of mine, but for very different sets of reasons. Marty Tankliff is here today. Marty is an exoneree who was wrongfully convicted of murdering his parents, which I get the chills just hearing myself say that. And he's going to share his remarkable story of going through what could be considered one of the most traumatic experiences that any human being could ever endure, and his subsequent triumph post-exoneration. You will be amazed at what he's been able to accomplish and overcome. We also have today Saul Kassin. Saul pioneered in the 80s the scientific study of false confessions by introducing a taxonomy that distinguished between three types of false confessions: voluntary, compliant, and internalized, that is universally accepted today. He has recently studied forensic confirmation biases and the impact that confessions have on judges, juries, lay witnesses, forensic science examiners, and the plea bargaining process. He is widely considered the foremost expert on false confessions. So welcome, both of you. thanks for coming in and joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Marty, let's start with you. So let's go back to, you grew up in Long Island.
I grew up in an affluent area called Belterre, New York, which is a little hamlet in Port Jefferson, New York, North Shore, Suffolk County. I went to Port Jefferson High School, where the norm was. We drove nice cars, we went on boats, and what happened to me was not something myself or anyone in my neighborhood could have ever imagined.
No, no one could imagine it. You had a happy childhood, nuclear family, right? You and your sister, your parents.
Idyllic, a little bit more idyllic because I was adopted, so my parents were older, so a lot of what we did growing up, my father lived vicariously through me because he didn't have a very good childhood. So, you know, we had the boats, the ATVs, we traveled a lot. People used to joke that I was a spoiled kid, and I was. But my father instilled amazing work values in me. I was working since I was probably 11 or 12 years old.
And he was the bagel king, right?
My father was an entrepreneur who invested with Jerry Stuerman, who was then known as the bagel king of Long Island. My father had invested over $500,000 with Jerry in his bagel stores and horses. And in the summer of 1988, their relationship significantly deteriorated. What I later learned was is that we believe my father learned that the bagel businesses may have been a money laundering operation for Jerry's son Todd's drug dealing business.
And we're talking hard drugs, not
hard drugs. Todd was arrested, went to prison for possession of cocaine, marijuana, and other drugs, and he served time in New York State prisons. But my father was a tough, older man. Nothing would stop him. And one of the things that he was involved with was is there was a weekly poker game. And on September 6th was his night to hold the weekly poker game. And one of the members at that game was Jerry Stuerman. My father was the type of man, it didn't matter, you know, how much threatening Jerry Stuerman did. And there were threats. We later learned about 2 weeks before September 6th, Jerry Stuerman threatened to cut my father's tongue out. And it got so bad that my father was even looking into buying a shotgun because he was fearful.
Now we've set the stage. There's the poker game, right? There's obviously, it's a tense environment, right, with the two of them in the room. But you went to sleep.
I went to sleep because September 7th was the first day of my high school year. I was going to be a senior. And I woke up and my life was never the same again. The lights were on in my house. The house wasn't locked up. Walked through the house.
You were upstairs?
It's a ranch house. It was a very long ranch house where the bedrooms were in one end of the house. Where the card game was in the complete opposite end of the house.
Right, so you wouldn't have heard anything.
Wouldn't have heard anything. And I discovered my father, who was still sitting in his office chair, and he was alive, and he was bleeding.
And what'd you do?
I called 911, and I followed their instructions.
Right, they told you to wrap him as best you could, gave you some medical tips, whatever, try to stop the bleeding,
yes.
That kind of stuff, right?
And within a short period of time, law enforcement showed up at the house.
And where's your mom?
My mother was actually in her bedroom. Cops come, and immediately they remove me from the house. And what I kind of can say now is that the process of questioning me, trying to find out what happened, started almost immediately. Even when I had family members show up that morning, there was this immediate separation. When my brother-in-law showed up, he was ripped away. When my godfather, who was also the family attorney, showed up, I saw him. He never saw me, but McCready, who was the lead detective, his name is K. James McCready, was the lead detective on the case, ran to him and basically told him I was already on the way to the hospital. I wasn't at the house, even though I was at the house. I was told consistently I was being taken to the hospital. Unfortunately, I was never taken to the hospital. I ended up being taken to police headquarters.
At this point, were you aware that your mom had been killed?
Yes.
So you're in a state of total shock, panic.
Words can't describe it.
Your parents were beaten to death, is that right?
There was a bludgeon instrument and a knife. And to this day, neither one has been discovered. And there was some forensic evidence, which I can talk about. There was glove prints. So whoever did do this were wearing gloves, that they still haven't found the gloves. So, I mean, there's all these little things that actually the jury was aware of, but they chose just to ignore.
So they took you to police headquarters because, and obviously this whole sort of pattern is emerging, right, where they wanted to, they had an agenda.
Yeah, I mean, at that day, I didn't know that.
No,
I mean,
of course
I was
not.
17 years old. My father was the police commissioner of our little community. I was raised to trust law enforcement, believe in them. Law enforcement wouldn't lie to you. They wouldn't deceive you. Unfortunately, that's everything that they did that morning.
Right, and you're in an extremely fragile state, and you need help.
Right.
You need someone to help you. You're 17 years old, right? We know that they have misled, is a probably a nice way to put it, his family guardian at this point, right? Your godfather, who was also the only lawyer that was available to you at this time, right?
They kind of misled everybody, though. I mean, I had other cousins and aunts and uncles who were at the hospitals, and they were lied to, too. They were told, Marty's on the way to the hospital. Marty's on the way to the hospital.
Right. So they're basically doing everything they can to prevent you from having any responsible guardian or legal representative that might be able to stand in the way of them getting the conviction that they wanted, regardless of truth.
Yes. There was no truth seeking here. I mean, you have a man who was business partners with my father, $500,000 involved, was there the night before. My father also had, in the weeks prior, had demanded, he had two notes, $50,000 back. In the days after the murders, Jerry Sturman cleaned out a joint bank account. He faked his death. He fled to California. He had a hair weave back then, and he went to a club that he wasn't a member of. He had five or six different aliases at that moment. But law enforcement never considered him a suspect. And every time I tell people, the average person would say, well, how is he not a suspect?
I mean, you could have stopped that he faked his own death. So let's get to the interrogation and the false confession and prison and the whole saga. Saul, you're obviously very familiar with Marty's case. You've known Marty since 1993, is that right?
He started writing letters to me from prison in 93.
So here's Marty in a state of panic and shock and grief. And as we discussed, he's still a child. And his confession is different than any of the other ones I've studied,
yes.
right? Because
yes.
it may or may not have ever even actually happened.
Right.
Right. Usually they actually get somebody to say something on video or they'll get a written statement or something. But in Marty's case, it's much more highly nuanced, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. And in Marty's case, you've got to ask yourself the first question. Why did Marty, a 17-year-old without a criminal record, without a history of violence, with good parents and good relationships in an affluent community, why would Marty kill his parents?
In a brutal way.
In the most brutal of ways. And you have to ask yourself the question, how in God's name did he become their suspect?
Most people said, he did it for the money. Because they thought my parents were affluent, the way the wills were structured, I would have gotten everything. And we later learned that law enforcement never really understood the way the wills, they never looked into the way the wills were structured. I wasn't going to benefit financially until I was 25. And I was 17. So, as one of my aunts said, what was he supposed to do from 17 to 25? Live on the streets?
So, Saul, there he is in the interrogation room, alone.
Alone. 17, not streetwise, never been in trouble before, never had to worry about how do you behave when you get picked up by police. He had done nothing wrong. And the funny thing about innocent people is even if they had read him his Miranda rights, he would have waived those rights.
Right, most people do.
So Miranda becomes not a safeguard that's particularly effective at this point. Keep in mind, they've got him in police headquarters. The whole family is with his father, who is dying but still alive in the hospital. That's where Marty wants to be. So he's already in a state where he's motivated to cooperate. And they start asking him questions about what he saw, how he saw it, what had happened. And he gives them answers, and the answers are consistent. They don't believe him. They tell him they don't believe him. They ask for the story to be told again. And they're searching for inconsistencies, and they're calling him a liar, and they're not believing the story that he keeps telling over and over again. But then they shift gears, and they shift gears toward a procedure now where they start to lie about the evidence. Now, the average American doesn't realize that in the United States, police are allowed to bring in a suspect and lie about the evidence. They're allowed to say to the suspect, we have your fingerprints on the murder weapon, even if that's not true. What happened in Marty's case is they bring him in. They say, it appears that your mother was in a struggle and there's hair in her grasp. And it turns out it's your hair. We did the analysis. It's your hair. And that confused Marty. It wasn't true, but he got confused as to how that was possible. And then because it was such a bloody scene, it was two bloody scenes, there just wasn't enough blood on Marty to account for that. They suggested to him that he had showered before calling 911. He said, no, I didn't use the shower. They came back and said, we did a humidity test in your bathroom, and we found that the shower had been used that morning.
A humidity test.
A humidity test. I don't believe even on CSI they've given us a humidity test. Now they've delivered two lies. And then the detective delivers the ultimate lie. He leaves the room. There are two detectives in there. The lead detective, McCready, leaves the room, stages a phone call, and comes back to deliver the news to Marty. Marty, I've got good news and I got bad news. I just spoke to the folks at the hospital. The good news is your father has come out of his coma. He's regained consciousness. The bad news is he said you did it. Now, think about this for a moment.
Fucking sick. It's really insane.
You've got a 17-year-old and you're now delivering one lie after another, culminating in a lie that to Marty, the person he trusts most in his life, has just said he committed this crime. And not only did Marty, of course, had no choice but to believe that evidence because he doesn't believe police would lie to him, certainly not like that. Even McCready's partner believed that presentation. So what choice does Marty have now but to wonder, how is it possible that they have this kind of objective evidence? My father doesn't lie, he said. Marty has almost no cognitive choice but to accept that information.
Well, because he's got two things, right? His father doesn't lie, and the cops don't lie.
Right.
These are the two things that he believes.
Exactly.
And so those things lead to one conclusion.
One conclusion. I must have done it. And the conversation turns to memory, consciousness, the possibility of sleepwalking and doing it without awareness, and generate theories for Marty to explain how come you don't remember doing this. So we know that that was the nature of the conversation. We know that for some degree of transient time, Marty became confused about even his own innocence. His confession was a handwritten statement, handwritten by the detective, that is inaccurate as a description of the crime. It doesn't complete itself. It actually ends in mid-sentence, and it is unsigned. This confession, the so-called confession, was written by the detective and not signed by Marty. And yet that allegation of that confession is the one and only piece of evidence that was used to convict him.
You're at trial. You still believe that justice is going to be done?
At trial, still believe it. I mean, this is what the lawyers are telling me. The system works. I was innocent. I testified on my own behalf. The prosecutors had charged me with intentional murder and depraved indifference murder. So when we got called back in, the first verdict that was read was not guilty. And then all of a sudden, the second one was guilty. The one thing I vividly remember is the walk after they read the guilty verdicts over to the county jail, because they had these tunnel systems. And I remember just, I felt like I was being led like a dog, because I was just listening. And I remember getting to the property room. And I remember the property room officer saying, "What are you doing here, Marty?" And I go, "Why else would I be here?" And then everything else went blank for about the next 6 or 7 days.
But now you're thrown into this environment. You're in maximum security prison. Is that right?
Yeah. I was basically every day it's a fight for your life because you never know in maximum security facilities what could happen, whether it be the gangs going to war with each other, the officers taking their aggression out on you, or just the random attacks that occur just for no reason whatsoever.
Right. I mean, we know that people are being killed every day in prisons in America, sometimes by guards even.
Absolutely. For me, my case was very high profile. So prisoners knew about the case, guards knew about the case. And I had a guy come up to me and he said, listen, he goes, if you want to survive, he says, don't do drugs, don't get involved in drugs, don't get involved in homosexuality, don't get involved in gambling, gangs. He said, and work your way into the college program or the law library. He said, one of the hardest things is, once you're innocent, is getting out. He said, but you'll figure out a way to do it. My lawyer said, okay, what's never been done here before? And we said a full investigation. And that's when I started looking for private investigators and ended up hiring Jay Salpeter. And one of the things that Jay said to me was, if you're innocent, hire me. If you're guilty, don't. I said, I'm innocent. I'll hire you. And I just find the truth, Jay. And it took years.
You ended up serving
6,338 days, which is about 17 and a half years.
Now, Now that we're up to speed from our 2017 release, and with Marty's civil litigation out of the way, he was finally able to tell us about the mountain of exculpatory evidence that they built, how his freedom came to pass, all of the amazing things he's been able to accomplish, and of course, his plans to finally bring the people who conspired to murder his parents to justice. Witnesses and evidence slowly emerged over the years, pointing towards a conspiracy involving at least Peter Kent, Joseph Creedon, Glenn Harris, and of course, the Stuermans. And more continues to come to light to this day. But the process started back in the early 90s when a woman named Carlene Kovacs went to a party.
In the early 1990s, Joseph Creedon, who was an enforcer for Todd Stuerman, was at a party where he admitted his involvement in the murders to Carlene Kovacs. So the idea that Todd Stuerman and Jerry Suman were responsible for this, not only from day one, but every year subsequent to my conviction investigation, more and more evidence would come forward, continuously pointing back towards the Stuermans. And it was around 1992, 1993, when we presented the DA's office with that information. And as the years would go on throughout the 1990s and the 2000s, the court system failed me.
It feels to me like the tide started to turn around 2003 when you hired Jay Saltpeter.
Jay started from the very beginning. It was kind of like, who benefited financially? And let's just start branching out from there. The criminal ties around the Stuermans was pretty well known when Jay took on this case of investigating it. And he just started looking at Todd Stuerman and Jerry Stuerman and started branching out. And eventually they found Glenn Harris. Glenn Harris said something to the effect that I've been waiting for this day for 12 or 13 years.
Glenn Harris gave a sworn statement saying that he had been hired by Stuerman to drive the two hitmen, Joe Creedon and Peter Kent, to and from the Tankleff house where you lived on the night of the crime.
And that just kind of started the snowball effect. We assembled a body of evidence of witnesses. And in 2005, we presented everything to the Suffolk County DA with the hopes that with their subpoena power and wiretap power, that they would actually take a real serious look at this case. And we said, you know, if you don't do anything after 45 days, we will file a post-conviction motion in New York. And we learned that it wasn't until the 44th day that they actually went out and went to interview the first witness. And we thereafter filed a post-conviction motion. Judge Braslow granted a hearing, and throughout the hearing, various technical issues came up and more witnesses came forward throughout the hearing.
Carlene Kovacs claimed that Joe Creedon told her about how he and another man hid in the bushes outside the Tankleff house, evaded capture, and got rid of the bloody clothes. And then there was more. There were family members of the killers, right? There were murder weapons that were actually had been hidden that were found. Am I wrong about that, Marty?
So the culminating witness at the hearing was Joseph Creedon's son, who said that his father confessed to him of his involvement. There was a pipe that was discovered on a piece of property that Glenn Harris said a pipe was thrown. Nobody knows if the pipe was actually used, but what are the chances that somebody could know or say, look, go search on this piece of property. We threw something there 18 years ago, 17 years ago, and it was found. The actual murder weapons, the knives have never been found.
By now, we're talking about 2005, 2006. The defense, your team, had assembled 20 witnesses, 20, who all painted collectively a picture of how Stuerman had orchestrated these murders. Two of the witnesses had seen McCready with Stuerman just before the murders. Hello. There was also the matter of the murder weapon not having been found. There was a bloody stain of what appeared to be a knife imprinted on one of Arlene Tankleff's sheets, but no match was found, suggesting that someone had taken it. But justice was right around the corner, right? So March 17th, 2006, the petition for the new trial was denied. But then December 2007, Tell us about that.
Well, in New York State, after you file a post-conviction motion, you have to seek permission to appeal the case. Thankfully, the appellate division that had denied me relief in 1993 had granted me permission to hear my case. And my lawyers argued before four amazing judges in September of 2007. And I remember it was December that I was calling home, calling the lawyers every single day, trying to find out how the decision come down. And I had four different appeals in the appellate division, including one for a new trial, one for DNA testing. So I was finally able to get through to one of my lawyer's offices, and the receptionist said to me, she's like, "Don't tell Bruce I told you, but we won the big one." And my legs started to shake a little bit, and I kind of almost didn't believe it, because it was kind of that moment when you are just waiting for that day, for day after day, year after year. And when I finally spoke to Bruce Barquette, I'll never forget his words. He said, "Pack your shit, you're coming home, and you'll never see the inside of a jail cell again." And at that very moment, don't ask me why I said this, but I was kind of sarcastic. And I said, "Bruce," I said, "I've been studying the law long enough. I said, it's an oral agreement, and I'm going to hold you to it." And he kept his word. I was brought down to the Suffolk County Jail December 26th, the day after Christmas. And on December 27th, I was freed, and I have never returned to a jail cell since. So Bruce Barquette kept his word.
In the book, A Criminal Injustice, which is I recommend so highly, it reads like a Grisham novel, but it's true, and you lived it. And in that book, one of the things that sticks out so much and about your story is that Suffolk County was like a criminal enterprise. And I'm talking about the justice system. Can you describe it?
Well, I think it was best described, I think it was William Hellerstein described it as the wild, wild west of law enforcement and the court system. And essentially he said is that in Suffolk County, they do whatever the hell they want to do, whenever they want to do it, because they are almighty. And I think that almighty attitude can be traced back to the homicide division, where in the 80s, they used to wear these shirts that said 99%. And that referred to their confession and conviction rates for homicide cases. And they were proud of it. And Suffolk County has a long history of turmoil and corruption. You know, when the attorney general reinvestigated the case during some of the post-conviction proceedings, they uncovered forensics that were in the possession of Suffolk County the entire time, and they proved to be exculpatory in nature. You know, it just goes to the depths of how sinister and evil the criminal injustice system was in Suffolk County back then, even up to recently, where the district attorney that was in office during my post-conviction litigation, Tom Spoda, was recently criminally charged while he was a district attorney. When Tom Spoda was in private practice, he and his firm had represented Todd Stuerman and Jerry Stuerman, and the chief of police, William Burke, was also criminally charged, and he went to prison.
It's unbelievable. And this gets deeper and deeper because McCready, the detective, was under investigation for perjury. And let's not forget, McCready went into business with your sister, who became the heir to the family fortune.
Shortly after my conviction, my half-sister threw a celebratory party at a country club for family and friends. And right around the same time, went into business with the money she received from my parents' estate, with the lead detective who put me in prison. And they opened up a bar restaurant, Diggero Dells in Riverhead, New York.
Yeah.
I didn't want to go down in history as being known as the person who was convicted of murdering my parents, because I didn't do it. And nobody stands criminally charged or convicted of those murders as of today. I knew that I wanted to continue fighting till the truth came out, and we continue to explore every lead. And even to this day, We've had new witnesses who have come forward, and the only reason why they've come forward was because Peter Ken and Joseph Crean have died. They've come forward with exculpatory evidence that no one has ever heard before that I'm hoping by the end of the year it will get out there.
Are you still hoping for the authorities to do what they should have done decades ago and prosecute the people responsible for this tragedy?
There is a new district attorney who ran on a line of exposing injustice. He set up a conviction integrity unit. He has clearly stated time and time again that he owes no allegiance to the prior administration, and I'm currently working on putting a package together. I'm confident that any fair-minded prosecutor, if they look at the body of evidence that we have now, someone should be criminally charged, and I'm going to be asking the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office to reopen the case.
July 22nd, 2008, the charges were dismissed and your life began again or anew. I mean, you hit the ground running, and there's so much to talk about still because there's the federal civil suit against New York State and the Suffolk County Police Department. And this was not a frivolous suit. In fact, in July 2014, New York State settled for $3.375 million. And in 2018, Suffolk County settled for another 10. They didn't do that willingly. They did that because they had no way out. I mean, you had them literally dead to rights. And then you go and graduate from law school. Now, I mean, seriously, Marty, like, are you trying to make the rest of us look bad? It's unbelievable.
I was just going to say is that, you know, when you say get up and start running, it was 3 weeks after I was out of prison. I started finishing up my bachelor's degree at Hofstra. And I knew that, you know, what I went through, no one should go through. And if there was somebody that could help make a difference, it would be me. I am out now. I'm a lawyer. I'm also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University and at Torah Law School.
There's a very hard to miss message of what the rest of us have as an excuse not to live out our dreams. I mean, that's an unbelievable transformation. And I am so, so proud of you. So you're now the head of the Prisoner and Civil Rights Litigation Group at Metcalf & Metcalf. You're living your best life. And they say living well is the best revenge. I think you can attest to that. But we can't leave alone the other thing that you're doing now, which I'm gonna guess is probably the most rewarding thing other than your family of everything, which is, of course, the Making an Exoneree program. You're, of course, as we talked about, an adjunct professor at Georgetown. Let's just say that again. You're a professor at Georgetown. Like, what the hell? Anyway, and you're working with your childhood friend and my dear friend, Mark Howard, co-teaching a class called Making an Exoneree. And one of the students from that class was on this show in our episode of the awful, awful case of Terrell Barros. And she said, and I think any of the students would say, that her life has been forever changed by this experience. So please, anyone, go back and listen to the Terrell Barros episode. Terrell really needs and deserves our help. Listen, and you'll get some ideas of how you may be able to make a difference in his life. He's just as innocent as Marty was and is. So tell us about some of the people that you've helped, wherever you want to go with this.
You know, just to give people a little background, and they can find a lot more on our website, makingexoneree.com. Mark and I have been friends since we were 3 years old going to Lovey Dovey preschool. And after I got out, Mark would invite me to come down to his class and speak to them about my experience, about the criminal justice system. And as the years went on, we started talking about the idea about teaching a class together. And the idea of Making Exoneree kind of came together one day of just us talking, taking undergraduate students and having them reinvestigate real cases of men and women in prison, try to track down new witnesses, and try to develop a body of evidence that could help get them exonerated. And their final project was to create short documentaries. And we started the class in 2018. And one of our cases was Valentina Dixon. And our students were able to uncover enough evidence that was shared with Valentino's lawyer, and he was exonerated in September of that year. And each year, our students have done this amazing work. And there's not a single student who's taken our class that hasn't walked away and said that the opportunity to try to impact someone's life is life-altering for them. Our students become friends with the individuals who are incarcerated. Tragically, John Moss, who was from our first semester, our students uncovered evidence that convinced the Innocence Project to represent him. Tragically, he passed away in Martin Luther King Jr. Day this year. But the students became so close to him and his family, they went to his funeral. I mean, it's kind of unheard of that students can develop a bond like that. Every one of the student groups, even after they've graduated, continue to work on any of the cases that they were connected with. And if they're in a position where they can't work, they want to know what's going on. Because in Valentino Dixon's case, when he walked free in September of 2018, Ellie and Julie, who were two of the young women that worked on his case, flew back from France and England to be there when he walked out of prison. And I think it's something that they will never forget their entire life. And Valentino has said time and time again that they have lifelong friends, and if they ever need anything, he would be there for them. The relationship you develop with these men and women is just different. You know, we walk in and we tell our students that there's no guarantees here other than you putting 1,000% in. And they do more than that. Our students can sometimes work 30 hours a week outside of class. They travel around the country. They track down witnesses. They confront former prosecutors. In one case, they confronted a currently sitting judge who was a former prosecutor. There really is no fear that our students have. And it's just, to me, an amazing experience having the opportunity to work with them. And it really doesn't even feel like work sometimes. It feels like such an honor and pleasure to work with students that want to come to class, want to work, want to sacrifice their time. And I remember this year when the idea of spring break or going to see somebody in a maximum security prison during spring break, our students said, who cares about spring break? Let's go to prison.
Who cares about spring break? Let's go to prison. Wow. That really does say it all. And the fact is that those of us who work in this area know that the first time you get to be a part, I don't care how small the part is, of helping somebody out of this Kafkaesque nightmare, it is unlike anything else that I've ever experienced. And it makes me feel useful. You know, you now get to live that to the 10th power or to the nth degree, whatever you want to call it, because you're doing it again and again, and you're doing it from a place that the rest of us can't possibly understand, and doing it for all the right reasons. So it's wonderful to see. And people can go to makinganexoneree.com and see these 8-minute videos, which are so powerful. And I know that every one of those students is going to be forever changed by this experience, and they're going to become freedom fighters in their own right. And so there goes the Marty Tankliff force multiplier effect. Marty, you've been on the show before. You know how it works. At this point, we turn to my favorite part of the show. It's the part of the show we call Closing Arguments, where, first of all, I thank you for being here, sharing your story, and just being this sort of beacon of hope and light that you are. And then I turn off my microphone, leave yours on for what we call closing arguments.
I remember when I talked about becoming a lawyer, I said, I don't think I can ever reach the pinnacle of exonerations of Barry Scheck or Steve Drizin or anybody like that. But I know if I'm instrumental in helping one innocent person walk free, you know, I kind of joke, I've done my job. And I was there the day Valentino walked out, but I'm far from over. You know, it is so rewarding. And I know, Jason, you've had the opportunity to be there when people have walked free and been involved in exonerations. It impacts your life in a way that I think nothing else does. And I know one of my lawyers said, you know, those who do this work are doing God's work. And he explained it was simply that, you know, when you fight to get somebody who's innocent out of prison, you're almost giving them an opportunity at new life. So it's almost like a rebirth for them, because some of them have been locked up longer than they were free. And now all of a sudden you help them gain their freedom back. It really is probably some of the most rewarding work. And, you know, Mark is somebody who is just amazing because, you know, Mark was a tenured professor of government. And it was because of his involvement and his choice to go to law school, to join my defense team, to fight to get me out of prison, that his career essentially changed, where he teaches prisons and justice. He goes into prisons and teaches college credit courses. He's established the Frederick Douglass Project. And Mark and I have made a decision that we will teach this class every year going forward, just because so many innocent people don't have the ability to have their voices told. You know, after Just Mercy came out, I told our students that you have to watch the scene where Jamie Foxx is talking to his lawyer after the evidentiary hearing, and he says something to the effect that even if I don't get out of prison, I'm good, because the truth came out. And that's what we empower our students to do. Get the truth out there, because those who are incarcerated, that's what they want. We can't control the criminal justice system, but we can control investigating these cases and telling the stories and having those who are incarcerated have their stories told through our voices. I think anybody who walks away and watches the videos will just find that our system is so flawed on so many levels, and everyone across America can do something. Because that's a question I'm sure you get asked all the time, what can we do? And we tell people, you know, find something you're good at and just offer to help. You know, whether it be writing a letter to somebody who's in prison, social media development, sharing, passing along petitions. If there are fundraising efforts, do fundraising. Because so often people sit back and say, I'm not a lawyer, I know nothing about the system. And when I tell people that the system is about humanity at its core, because our system succeeds and fails based on humans on so many levels, that if we go deep into our hearts, we can find something that we can do to make a difference.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company Number 1.
From PRX.